Well, it's lovely to be with you, and thank you for coming out today. And I've just been remembering, I grew up in the Anglican Church. My dad was a vicar. He sadly died when he was very young and when I was very young. But after that, my mum trained in the Anglican Church and was one of the first women ordained priest in the Anglican Church. So, confession time, I'm an Anglican at heart. But what we used to do every Sunday when we gathered was to say the words we just sung. We declared our faith together. And I'm reading a book currently. I'm reading lots of books, and I read them all at the same time, so I read them very slowly. It's not particularly good, really. But one of them I'm reading at the moment is a book based on the Creed by Alistair McGrath. If you've ever read any of Alistair McGrath, fabulous. Very, very clever man, but writes in a very, very simple way. So if you're interested in finding out what stands behind what you've just sung, I recommend that book to you. Something about Faith is the title. That's how good I am. I can't even remember the name of the title. But anyway, Alistair McGrath grew up, well, he was at university with Richard Dawkins and actually went to university as an atheist himself because he thought he was going to find the answers in science. And the more he studied science and biology and biochemistry, he came to the conclusion that he could not be an atheist. And you might have come across the book, The Dawkins Delusion. Sorry, the God Delusion, written by Richard Dawkins. Well, Alistair McGrath wrote a response to that called The Dawkins Delusion, just challenging some of the things he said in it. So it's interesting how they started in the same place and have ended up in very different places. Anyway, that's got nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about today, but it's on here. Your banner here, look. Serving Jesus and the community since 1882. Did you know that Godston has been serving the community 1 year longer than Crawley Baptist Church? Because Crawley Baptist started in 1883. And I'm very pleased I know that. Serving the community since 1882. And down here, I'm sure you know this, you've got these. Knowing, growing and going. And going says to serve him in our daily lives. And this morning we're going to be talking about serving. And I've discovered over the years that there are certain things you can talk about as a minister. And before you even start, everybody feels guilty. One of them is prayer. One of them is giving. And one of them is serving. Because you'll probably come this morning slightly anxious if you knew what was going to be spoken about, thinking, oh no, we're going to be told we're not doing enough. And the idea of this talk will be, what more could you do in service? Well, I hope that's not what's going to happen this morning. That is not my intent, but I want to come at it perhaps slightly more broad. And this is what you say you are about here. So I hope these words this morning are helpful in helping you think about how this might be in the community that you call Godston Baptist Church. Now, in fairness, I have preached this sermon in Crawley. So I'm not going to say anything to you that I haven't already said to the brothers and sisters over there. So I'm not doing it. It's all fair. And I'll say this again. Because we have values in our church just like you do. And one of our values is servant hearts. And our value of servant hearts said this. We will serve those in the local community and beyond with integrity and love. That's just another way of saying that. So actually we're all trying to do the same thing, aren't we? So we're going to think about being people who have servant hearts. So my first question to you this morning is simply this. How is your heart this morning? It's very interesting actually. We support a Bible translation project through Wycliffe in the Cameroon. And they were saying that one of the challenges of translating into a language that's never been written down is first you've got to figure out how to write it down. But then you've got to figure out all the important nuances. So, for example, we consider the heart, figuratively, to be the center of our being, don't we? So I ask the question, how's your heart? You all know what I mean. If you were to do that in the Cameroon, you'd have to ask, how's your liver? Because their liver is the most important organ. So the translation of the Bible wouldn't talk about the heart, you know, God looks at the heart, he looks at the liver. You know what I mean when I ask, how's your heart? In 1978, M. Scott Peck wrote a book which became a worldwide bestseller. You may have read it. It became one of the most popular psychology books ever written. Its title is The Road Less Travelled. It begins with these three words. Life is difficult. Now, you didn't need a psychologist to tell you that, did you? We all know that life is difficult. And the premise of the book is that to live well, you must accept that life is difficult and confront it head on. That is the road less travelled. Because most people choose the other option. They choose the path of least resistance. When it comes to having a servant heart, which road do we choose? The road less travelled or the road of least resistance? We may not be able to change our circumstances. But when it comes to having a servant heart, this is something that we can change. We may not be able to change our circumstances, but we can change the attitude of our heart. When we choose to follow the road less travelled, we choose to follow in the steps of the Master who said, "I have come not to be served, but to serve." Now, if you remember nothing else from today, remember these three words. And then some. And then some. They're not original to me, I've borrowed them. But these words sum up what I think is about servant hearts this morning. I'm going to read a story where there is an attitude of "and then some" that is, I think, wonderfully portrayed. And it is the story of someone with a servant heart. So if you have a Bible and you want to follow this, I'm going to read from Genesis chapter 24, and I'm going to read the first 19 verses. You'll be very familiar, I'm sure, with this story. Genesis chapter 24, beginning at verse 1. Abraham was now very old, and the Lord had blessed him in every way. He said to the senior servant in his household, the one who had in charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh. I want you to swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I am living, but will go to my country, my own relatives, and get a wife for my son Isaac." The servant asked him, "What if the woman is unwilling to come back with me to this land? Shall I then take your son back to the country you came from?" "Make sure that you do not take my son back there," Abraham said. "The Lord, the God of heaven, who brought me out of my father's household and my native land, and who spoke to me and promised me on oath, saying, 'To your offspring I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, so you can get a wife for my son from there. If the woman is unwilling to come back with you, then you will be released from this oath of mine. Only do not take my son back there." So the servant put his hand under his thigh of his master Abraham and swore an oath to him concerning this matter. Then the servant left, taking with him 10 of his master's camels loaded with all kinds of goods from his master. He set out for Aram Naharim and made his way to the town of Nahor. He had the camels kneel down near the well outside the town. It was toward evening, the time women go out to draw water. Then he prayed, "Lord God of my master Abraham, make me successful today and show kindness to my master Abraham. See, I am standing beside this spring and the daughters of the townspeople are coming out to draw water. May it be that when I say to a young woman, 'Please let down your jar that I may have a drink,' and she says, 'Drink, and I'll water your camels too,' let her be the one chosen you have chosen for your servant Isaac. By this I will know that you have shown kindness to your master." Before he had finished praying, Rebekah came out with a jar on her shoulder. She was the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, who was the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor. The woman was very beautiful, a virgin. No man had slept with her. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, and came up again. The servant hurried to meet her and said, "Please give me a little water from your jar." "Drink, my lord," she said, and quickly lowered the jar to her hands and gave him a drink. And after she had given him a drink, she said, "I'll draw water for your camels too, until they have had enough to drink." Abraham is an old man and his wife has died. The time has come for Isaac, his only son, you'll remember, to be married. The future of Israel rests on Isaac. For as yet there is no nation, for Isaac has no wife. And on this future wife rests the shape of a nation. So Isaac needs a special kind of wife. And Abraham is very aware of it. Question is, how does Abraham find a wife for Isaac? There were no dating agencies in that time, as far as we're aware. And it was the custom for parents to go and find a wife. Here you go, son. Here's the girl we found for you. Can't imagine me doing that with my 20-year-old son. Here you go. His name happens to be Isaac, although he likes to go by the name Zach. Here you go, Zach. Here's the girl we found for you. I'm not sure how well that would go down. Abraham, being old, calls his servant, probably Eliezer, to look for a wife. They are both very aware that this is a big deal, because it has to do with the promises of God to Abraham. So Eliezer sets out for Abraham's homeland to find a wife. He takes with him a caravan of 10 camels laden with gifts, which he would need to exchange for a wife. Interesting. Exchanging camels for a wife. I have a story that I sometimes read at weddings. It's called Eight Cow Wife, because it's from an island where you traded cows in order to get a wife. 2 to 3 cows was considered a good price. The man in this story gives 8 cows, and everyone thinks his father-in-law's got him. But he actually says, look, when I pay that much for the woman I love, that's how I treat her. It's a very powerful story. Apparently true. But here, it's camels. So he arrives at Nahor and gets his camels to kneel down, and then he prays. Maybe because he doesn't know what else to do. And he prays for a sign that he would know who should be the wife for Isaac. Now, in those days, hospitality was very, very important. Everyone took it seriously. And it was often, in fact, a matter of life and death. Certainly, it was about character. You offer hospitality. It's a demonstration of your character. And Eliezer waits. Then Rebecca turns up at the well. The text tells us she was a very beautiful woman. So she gives Eliezer a drink, and then it happens. She offers to give the camels a drink until they have finished drinking. Anybody got any idea how much water a camel can drink? Does anybody know? Yeah, it is a lot. I went a few years ago on a trek across the desert. I was on sabbatical, and this trek across the desert was called In the Footsteps of Moses. And I thought, well, I can sell that to the church, can't I? That's an easy one. So we trekked for 5 days in the Sinai Desert, starting at Mount Sinai, or one of the places they think Mount Sinai is, walking east to the Red Sea. And we had camels with us. We had Bedouin guides, and they had their camels with us. And for 5 days they didn't drink. Because camels can go, can't they? But when a camel drinks, boy, can it drink. A thirsty camel can evidently drink up to 30 gallons of water. Eliezer has 10 camels. So let's assume for a moment that these camels are going to drink the capacity that a camel can drink. The math's not hard, is it? It's 300 gallons of water. Go back to your camping days when you had to trudge down to the tap and fill up your whatever it was gallon thing and then drag it all the way back. We even invented them with wheels on, didn't we? Maybe a few gallons of water. This is 300 gallons of water Rebecca has offered to draw from the well. That's a serious job. Rebecca, in her culture, did everything that could be reasonably expected of her, and then some. Everything that could have been reasonably expected of her, and then some. And it was the "and then some," her servant heart, that made all the difference. Her servant heart, her "and then some" attitude changed her life And it changed history. Rebecca went on, as you know, to marry Isaac, and she began a great adventure with the living God. And down successive generations, her name has been remembered and is still remembered and still celebrated. Imagine the transformation that could happen in Godstone Baptist Church, or where you happen to live or work, in your home life, in your relationships, if you're married in your marriage, with your parents, with your children, your grandchildren, perhaps even with your physical health, in your mind, in your soul, in this community, if you served with an and then some attitude. Here's the rub. You can do this. It is not beyond your control. There are lots of things we cannot change. But this one, we can. We can make the choice to say, I will do everything reasonably expected of me, and then some. Jesus talks about this attitude in his Sermon on the Mount, doesn't he? If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go 2 miles. Now the background to this verse is that when Jesus lived, the country, as you know, was occupied by the Romans. Roman soldiers were a common sight, and would often be forced to go on 50-mile marches. And on these marches, they had to carry their heavy packs on their backs. But Roman law allowed them to draft in people to carry their pack or their burden for 1 mile. After 1 mile, their legal obligation was over, and they could then give the pack back to the Roman soldier. That's the context. So if you happen to be walking along the road and the Romans are walking past you, they can force you to carry their pack for 1 mile, then you could give it back. As you can imagine, this was not a popular practice. Jesus is saying, look, you have to do the 1 mile because the law requires it. Most people will resent it. But why don't you be different? Every now and again, blow the mind of a Roman soldier by offering to carry his pack for an extra mile. Let me serve you. Now, Jesus is not being legalistic. He's not saying you have to do this every time. And he's not saying we have to tolerate abuse or injustice. He knows very well we have to exercise judgment and set appropriate boundaries. But what he is saying is, if you want to live the values of the kingdom, if you want to have a kingdom heart, be a servant. Every now and again, blow somebody's mind by carrying their pack an extra mile. We are going. We're going to serve him in our daily lives. And what I like about that is it doesn't say church, does it? It doesn't say we'll serve him in the church. Because after all, that's all ministers want from you, isn't it? We just want you to do it in the church. No. In the community. Wherever God has placed us. Because wherever we go, remember, the kingdom of the heavens goes. Because we carry the kingdom of the heavens with us. We will serve those in the local community beyond with integrity and love. Every now and again, we will blow their mind. How much do you settle for just getting by? What would be the impact if we, as a community of Christians here and in all the places Christians are, who did everything reasonably expected of us, and then some? My guess will be that in this church there are lots of you who serve. And you do it graciously and generously. I'm very well aware that church is mostly run on the contribution of volunteers. However many paid staff you have, still, most of what gets done in the life of a church is done by people who volunteer to do it. Paid staff do what's reasonably expected of them, and then some, certainly in every church I've ever been in, but so do volunteers. And whatever happens in church can only be done because people like you do what's reasonably expected, and then some. There was a guy in our church, he can't do it now because he had a stroke. But I used to arrive quite early. One morning I arrived at 7 o'clock on a Monday morning to write a sermon because it's quiet. The building gets busy, so I get there early. And a man called Brian was already at the church. He's not a paid staff, he's just a volunteer. So I went to say good morning. I went up to the hall upstairs to find that he had already set out the tables. This is 7 o'clock in the morning. He'd already set out the tables for the preschool playgroup that happens there on a Monday morning. And he told me that he'd arrived at 6 o'clock that morning. He'd already washed the floor in the hall before he set out the tables. And he used to do that kind of thing all the time. He used to get to the church at 5 o'clock in the morning because he liked doing it. And then some. We recently just done a couple of Alpha courses. We used to do it years ago, and we haven't done it for a long time, but we decided to reinvest in it, and we just finished two Alpha courses, one on a Wednesday lunchtime and one on a Thursday evening. I didn't have anything to do with it. It was run by somebody else in the church. And he brought this letter to us at our little staff meeting. We get together each morning, and he read this letter out and said, can I take a copy of that letter? This is a letter somebody wrote to the church, thanking them for Alpha. And the reason I'm reading this to you is because Alpha only happens because most of the people in it volunteer. And they turn up and they get food and they wash up. And some of them come straight from work on a Thursday night. They don't even go home. You get the idea. You've done it yourselves. This is what somebody wrote. Dear Chris, he's the guy who led it. Thank you and your team for giving up your time for the Alpha course. I really enjoyed these weeks spent with so much love and friendship, meeting and getting to know new people. I know that I am not alone. God is with me, helping me. Since coming to the church, I feel that his love is all around me. She happens to live in a bungalow just behind the church, and we run some things on a Tuesday afternoon, and we invited her to those, and she started coming. She said, it's changed my life coming on a Tuesday afternoon in so many ways. The team are so understanding with love and friendship. I truly feel I am part of God's loving family again, not standing there on the outside like I thought I was. Alpha has helped me to see that God wanted me to come back to be part of his loving family. I needed God back in my life in so many ways. Now, people only write that kind of letter because people volunteer and they do what is reasonably expected of them and then some. Now, I'm sure that if we spent a moment now, you could tell me lots of examples of that. I'm not saying it's only happening in Crawley. I know that's not true. But when people do what's reasonably expected of them, and then some, we begin to see the kingdom of the heavens at work, don't we? You are a blessing to the community when you have a servant heart. What happened to Rebecca as a result of what she did? Well, suppose we'd said to her, look, Rebecca, if you do this job, which would take you just a couple of hours, you will go on to have the adventure of your life. You will meet the man of your dreams, wealthy, handsome. You will have a good character. You will travel. You will be the beginning of a whole nation. You will be the mother of the Messiah. Your name will be remembered and celebrated throughout human history. All of this, if you just do a job, that will take you just a couple of hours. The point is, Rebecca didn't have a clue what was going to happen when she offered to give the camels a drink. She went the second mile simply because she had a servant heart. Jesus said, give, and it will be given to you. This is simply the truth that the way to abundant living is through freely chosen servanthood. Servanthood asks the question, how can I delight and astound the people I am serving? Doing what is reasonably expected, and then some. So here's the challenge in three areas of life. First, in work, if that's what you're in, or home life, or volunteering. I'm going to ask you, you know, I'm going to ask you to do this out loud. You can do this quietly in your heart. Ask you to rate yourself on how much you are, and then some person, in this area of your life. So on a scale of 1 to 10, rate yourself where 10 would be, I do everything with all my strength, I have appropriate levels of commitment for work, I'm not a workaholic, but I seek to be stretched and challenged, and then some. And where a 1 might be, I do just enough to get by, my favourite phrase is, that's not my job. Where would you put yourself? And then maybe ask yourself this question. What one thing could I do tomorrow to be an and then some person in this area of my life? The second area of challenge, relationships, friends, family. Would the people whom I am in relationship with say that I am an and then some kind of person? Apparently, I don't know how they work this out, but apparently being a homemaker, and that's anything to do with making a home work, is rated as one of the toughest jobs there is. So on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 would be something like this. I am an and then some person in relational life. I am a servant around the house. I do acts of service and I do them with a willing heart. I keep channels of communication open. I express affection in creative ways. I confront people when it would be easier not to. I challenge them when it would be easier not to, but I do it with a spirit of love. And where a 1 might be, I just get by in my relationships. I generally choose the path of least resistance. I avoid confrontation. I rarely express my heart in creative ways. And the question then becomes, what one step could I take tomorrow to go the second mile in one of my relationships? What attitude could I change? And then perhaps a third area, it would be your relationship and my relationship with God. Where a 10 might be, I diligently seek to know God better. Where a 1 might be, I just get by, I don't think about it very much, what's the least I have to do? So maybe the question becomes, what one step could you take to becoming an and then some kind of person, a person with a servant heart? Now, I didn't plan this next bit, but actually it's quite lovely, because the next little bit of my notes lead us into communion, which I didn't know was happening today, and I've been asked to lead. Because here's the deal, right? The truth is, God loves you, and then some. He loves you because he loves you, 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 because he loves you. He is and then some God. And when we remember what we call communion, that's what we are remembering. Here is the God who says, I love you so much that I will do everything it is possible to do to win the affection of your heart. Now remember the story of Abraham. What was God trying to do in the story of Abraham? God's decided he's going to choose one man, and through one man he's going to show the people how it works. This is the best way to live. And out of that it creates a nation, doesn't he? And interestingly, he starts a nation with three couples who are childless. Have you noticed that? Three couples who are childless. And he said, I'm going to make a nation out of you. What's going on there? Well, God is saying, maybe this is down to me. I'm the one who brings new life. Only I can do this. And then the ancient nation of Israel comes along, and God spends the whole of the Old Testament wooing them, trying to bring them back, doesn't he? Do you know, we preached through Ezekiel not long ago. You ever read Ezekiel? God, it sounds really complicated, Ezekiel. But it's really simple. I figured it out. The whole of Ezekiel is only a few words. It's come back. It's better that way. Everything God does, all these bizarre things you read in Ezekiel, and some of it is really bizarre. All God is doing is saying, come back. It's better that way. Come back. It's better that way. Come back. It's better that way. You remember when they wanted a king? Israel goes, we want a king, we want a king, we want a king, we want to be like everyone else. And God says, no, it's not going to be that way. I am your king. Saddest chapter in the Bible, in my opinion, is 1 Samuel chapter 8. Where the people say, we want a king, we want a king. And God says, let me tell you how it'll be if you have a king. And they go, we want a king anyway. And at the end of it, God changes his mind. There's a theological bomb for you. And says, okay, then go back to your villages and I'll give you a king. What happens? They get a king. What happens to the king? Well, Saul's chosen because he's good looking. He hides under the baggage. He starts off well but finishes really badly. David was a good king, but he fouled it up, didn't he? He made mistakes. Solomon starts really well and it all goes pear-shaped. And turns out God was right. So all the way through the Old Testament, God's saying, come back, it's better that way. Come back, it's better that way. Because I want to win the affection of your heart. When that doesn't work, what does he do? He says, okay, then I'll give you my son. Why do I give you my son? Because I love you so much, I am going to go the extra mile. Because I am, and then some kind of God. I will do everything I can do to win the affection of your heart. And actually, we started the sermon all the wrong way around, because us serving comes out of our response to the God who loves us because he loves us because he loves us. And then we live in a way that reflects his character. So we are remembering today the and then some God. So why don't you just take a moment to reflect on that.